Welcome to the Sports Law Biz Podcast, dedicated to helping people better understand the law and business of sports. I'm your host, Peter Ott, and we've got a lot to talk about here today, so why don't we just jump in? Hello, this is Peter Ott of the Sports Law Biz Podcast, and I'm here with Professor J. Gordon Hilton, and we're going to be talking about the baseball antitrust exemption today. And so let's just start off with an introduction. Professor, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yes, my name is Gordon Hilton. I went to Oberlin College and the University of Virginia Law School. I also have a PhD in the history of American civilization from Harvard University. I've been interested in the field of sports law and sports history throughout my whole academic career. I've twice been the chair of the Association of American Law Schools section on law and sports, and from 1997 to 1999, I was the director of the National Sports Law Institute, which is based at Marquette University in Milwaukee.
Okay, and it should be added that Professor Hilton is one of my law school professors. He's a great professor, a great legal mind, and a historical mind. He's got a lot to share with us today, so let's get started with this at a basic level. Professor, what is antitrust law?
Well, antitrust law actually has very little to do with trust. In most countries, it's called competition law. So antitrust law are statutes that regulate the operation of the marketplace so that competition remains fair and that powerful economic actors don't establish harmful monopolies. We mostly think of antitrust law today as federal law, although most states also have their own state antitrust statutes.
Okay, so this is when people fear big companies, Walmarts or something like that. This is to prevent a big company from exercising its economic power in a way that's harmful to America or people.
Right, that's a major part of it. The other major part is to keep companies, smaller companies, from forming cartels where they cooperate for their own advantage to the disadvantage of their other competitors or to the public.
Okay, and so who's subject to antitrust law? Is it all companies?
Well, at the state level, any company in the state would be subject to state antitrust law. But realistically, state antitrust law has not played a very important role in the development of the American economy. It's federal antitrust law that has been so important. Technically, the theory is only companies that are engaged in interstate commerce, which then gives Congress the power to regulate them. But as a practical matter, that includes almost all large companies in the United States.
Okay. Is this a relatively recent area of law, or does it date from the founders? How long have we had it in America?
Modern antitrust law really dates from the adoption of the Sherman Antitrust Act in 1890. It was a consequence of the industrialization of the United States and the growth of large, powerful corporations.
Okay. So Major League Baseball, obviously a big corporation, raking in a lot of revenue and things like that. The point of this podcast is discussing their antitrust exemption. So I take that to understand that baseball is not subject to antitrust law?
Yes, this is one of the great anomalies in the history of American antitrust law. There are certain types of economic activity that are always exempt. State governments, for example, cannot violate the federal antitrust laws, but normally any powerful economic actor can. But because of this 1922 Supreme Court decision called Federal Baseball, at a time when the Supreme Court interpreted interstate commerce much more narrowly than it has in the modern era, the court ruled that the process of putting on exhibitions of professional baseball was not a form of interstate commerce, and therefore the Major League Baseball and organized baseball were not subject to the antitrust laws. And in one form or another, that exemption has remained ever since.
Okay, so just to recap, antitrust law applies to interstate commerce, any corporation involved in interstate commerce. And in a baseball game where one team comes, say, from Boston and another team comes from New York, if those two teams play in New York in federal baseball, the Supreme Court would say that's not interstate commerce, even though the two teams come from different places.
Right. The problem isn't that it's not interstate. And again, this is from the perspective of how the Supreme Court interpreted the law in 1922. The problem was that sporting exhibitions, the court did not believe, met the definition of commerce. in that era, commerce was understood to mean trade, the actual transfer of manufactured or produced goods from one state to another. And since every baseball game was different, you had the teams crossing state lines, but the game they played existed only in the state where the game was played. So the court reasoned in the 1920s that this meant that Major League Baseball was not a form of interstate commerce. Now, by the late 1930s, the court with different judges had concluded that commerce really meant business, not just trade. And so that's what left the baseball antitrust exemption as something of an anomaly.
Okay, so according to federal baseball, because it was just produced in one state, it wasn't commerce because there wasn't the trade element.
Exactly.
But the Supreme Court later changed that understanding of what commerce means to include things that are just produced in one state as long as there's the interstate element.
Exactly. Also worth noting, in 1922, there was really no broadcasting. There had been isolated broadcasts of professional baseball games on radio, but there wasn't even any regular broadcasts of games on radio, let alone television. So certainly 20 years later, one could argue that baseball games were being produced in one state and then transported over the airwaves to another. But the Supreme Court, of course, the reason we're talking about the antitrust exemption here in 2015, the Supreme Court has had several opportunities to reverse itself, to reverse its 1922 ruling, but it has always declined to do so.
Okay, so let's talk about some of those cases where it had that opportunity. There's the 1953 Toulson case. This is after the radio has come about as a way of distributing games across state lines. You know, there's obviously a lot of money involved by this time. The Supreme Court's interpretation of commerce has brought in to include conceivably baseball games, but the antitrust exemption survived this case.
That's right. The Toulson case was actually a combination of three cases, but all of which involved minor league baseball players whose ability to play on the team of their choice was extremely limited by baseball's reserve rules, which meant that the team with which the player originally signed was the team the player had to play for unless the team assigned his contract to another team. And Toulson was an employee of the New York Yankees, although he was a minor league player. He wanted to go back home to California to play for a team in the Pacific Coast League. They were willing to take him as a player, but the Yankees wanted him to play in Binghamton, New York, one of their minor league teams, and they refused to let him. Even though his contract had expired, they refused to allow him to play for the team he wanted to. And under baseball rules at that time, they had the perfect right to do that. So Toulson and his lawyers argued that this was a violation of the antitrust laws. An ordinary business couldn't lock up an employee for the remainder of his career. And so Toulson sued the New York Yankees and then appealed to the United States Supreme Court.
Okay, so if Toulson was, say, a doctor working at a hospital in New York and wanted to go work at a different hospital in California, and that hospital in California did hire him, he would be able to work there.
Right, and even if Toulson had, even if Dr. our hypothetical Dr. Toulson had signed a contract with the hospital where he agreed that he would only leave the hospital if the hospital permitted him to do, under standard antitrust law, that contract would be illegal and
okay,
therefore unenforceable. His baseball contract, though, had exactly that same provision, that he could only play for the team that his previous team assigned him to play for. And that, though, was not illegal, at least if baseball was exempt from the antitrust laws.
Okay, because baseball, as we have the conception of it, is a group of different teams organized in leagues that make these rules that they all honor. And that, you know, in a traditional idea of a bunch of corporations getting together and coming up with rules that they all honored, you know, that prevent people from pursuing employment or whatever, that would be illegal.
Right, and this is a sort of classic, in this sense, organized baseball, which was the major leagues and the minor leagues, which agreed by contract to cooperate and observe each other's rules, was really just a cartel, like OPEC is a cartel. And, of course, cartels are exactly the type of economic activity that the antitrust laws are designed to limit or prohibit.
Right.
And yet, the baseball cartel, was operating without these concerns because of this 1922 Supreme Court decision that said it was not interstate commerce and therefore it was not subject to the federal antitrust laws. And that's what Toulson was challenging.
Okay. Yeah. And I think the average fan doesn't think of professional sports leagues or minor sports leagues as cartels in the same way that they would as oil companies, because you see the obvious effect if a bunch of oil countries or companies get together to restrain trade, it leads to higher oil prices and things like that. But that same principle applies to sports teams. We can see that this restrained Toulson's opportunity to go somewhere else, and it hurt him by a bunch of potential employers getting together.
Yes.
Okay, and Toulson challenged them under antitrust laws, saying that this was illegal, and his suit failed.
Right. He argued that the Supreme Court's decisions post-1922 had effectively overruled the federal baseball decision back in 1922. But although there were dissenting justices, the majority of the court disagreed with Toulson. Now, the reason for their disagreement was interesting, because they didn't say that baseball was no longer interstate commerce. They essentially recognized that it had, even if it wasn't in 1922, in 1953 it was a form of interstate commerce. However, because the baseball industry had developed under the assumption that it was immune from antitrust regulation, the court held that Congress would have to change the law, which of course assumed that Congress hadn't intended to include Major League Baseball under the coverage of the Sherman Antitrust Act. So in some ways, the Supreme Court in 1953 tossed the ball to Congress, which actually had been investigating baseball as a monopoly. In the two previous years, Congress had held extensive hearings about monopolization in the baseball industry.
Okay, so Congress held these hearings looking into making potential changes to antitrust law, perhaps to include baseball in some way, but they didn't make any changes. And so the Supreme Court said, since Congress is looking at making these changes and didn't make these changes, we're just going to assume that since they didn't originally consider it to be commerce and didn't make any changes after looking at it, they still don't.
Right. So that left the baseball antitrust exemption intact, although now rooted under a different theory. No longer that baseball somehow was a game or not a business. No longer that baseball was not interstate commerce, but rather essentially that Congress had not intended to include the baseball industry under the Sherman Antitrust Act.
Okay, so we have the Toulson decision, and that's an important decision in the history of the antitrust exemption. Now moving on to later case law, one case that stands out is the case of Flood versus Kuhn. Would you care to summarize that?
Sure. Flood versus Kuhn was a 1972 United States Supreme Court decision, but it really just revisits the Toulson argument almost 20 years later, except in this case, Curt Flood was a prominent and well-known Major League Baseball player who had been traded in the middle of his career from the St. Louis Cardinals to the Philadelphia Phillies. And of course, under the reserve rules, he had no option since his contract had been assigned to Philadelphia, but he didn't want to leave St. Louis. He didn't want to play for Philadelphia. So he decides to challenge the rationale of Toulson. So, again, with a former Supreme Court justice, Justice Goldberg, as his lawyer, he begins the process in the lower federal courts of arguing that Toulson was wrongly decided and that it should be overturned. And then, to the surprise of many people, though, in the 72 decision of Flood versus Kuhn was the name of the baseball commissioner at the time, the Supreme Court upholds the baseball's antitrust exemption under the theory of stare decisis, i.e., if something has been the law for a long time and people have relied upon it, then that is an independent reason for leaving the law as it is, even if a more logical argument would be to change the law. So Flood lose, just like Toulson lost, Flood lost.
Okay, yeah, and I think that case is particularly interesting because the Supreme Court, in the decision that they put out, made comments that this antitrust exemption is illogical, it's inconsistent, it's certainly an anomaly from the way normal antitrust law works. But even notwithstanding all of that, all of these words that they put making you think that they would rule the other way, they decided to maintain the status quo following the principle of stare decisis.
That's right. And, of course, one thing that made the decision even more controversial, or, as you put it, illogical, was that in 1957 the Supreme Court had ruled that professional football had no similar antitrust exemption, and then later cases by extension extended the full application of the antitrust laws to the National Hockey League, to the National Basketball Association, to every other form of professional sports, including the American Softball Association. So the antitrust rules even apply to other forms of baseball, even if they're amateur, but they don't apply to Major League Baseball because of federal baseball and then Toulson. So it really is a carve-out of just one sport, even though all other sports and the professional and amateur organizations, including the NCAA, was found to be subject to the antitrust laws. So it did create a true baseball antitrust exemption. And part of Flood's argument was that this is just completely irrational. There's no reason why one sport should be exempt and the other not. But the court says, yes, there is, because we've always said that baseball was exempt, whereas there's no case that specifically said that the NFL was exempt from the antitrust laws.
Yeah, and I find that particularly interesting. I think it was Justice Douglas that wrote the opinion. Do you remember?
One of the dissenting.
He won't run the dissenting.
It was Justice Blackmun wrote the
majority. Blackmun, yes. And in his opinion, you know, he kind of goes through the history of baseball. He name drops a lot of famous baseball players and stuff like that. And people like Flood and people sympathetic to him see that as a way that of saying that the justices were kind of starry-eyed in the way that they looked at baseball, that they were just kind of saying, you know, baseball is America, it's apple pie, and that clouded their judgment of to what they thought was a clear case that the exemption should be overturned.
Yeah, and another irony in that regard is that at the very moment that they're celebrating baseball as something distinctive and special and unique, public opinion polls were showing that the National Football League had actually supplanted Major League Baseball as the most popular sports league in America.
As early as 1972, it was very popular. Yeah, so, I mean, that adds an interesting wrinkle into the case, but certainly the justices stated that they were relying on stare decisis, and that's a doctrine that's used over and over again in court decisions. So
And once again, as in Toulson, the court is not saying that this can't be reversed. It's still saying that if it's going to be reversed, it's going to be Congress that has to do it. And even though there have been many bills introduced over the years in Congress that would have taken away baseball's antitrust exemption, it is true that none have ever passed, at least until the so-called Curt Flood Act at the end of the 20th century.
Okay. So yeah, that's the end of Flood v. Kuhn. Just a footnote, Bowie Kuhn is a UVA alumnus, right?
A UVA law school.
UVA
alumnus.
Law school, just like me. So we have that in common.
And actually appeared in one North Ground Softball League game, the Softball League of the University of Virginia Law School.
Okay, yeah. So that's just kind of a fun fact for those of us affiliated with the school. So now let's move on. We've talked a little bit about how baseball's antitrust exemption compares with antitrust treatment of other leagues. So you said that in this Radovich case, the NFL and eventually the other leagues were ruled not to have any antitrust protection, that they're all subject completely to antitrust laws just like other companies?
Well, that's the general rule. In 1961, Congress did enact a statute called the Sports Broadcasting Act that exempted certain types of broadcasting practices from the antitrust laws. But under the Sports Broadcasting Act, baseball, football, hockey, and basketball are all treated equally. So there, in that case, for this very limited feature of certain aspects of broadcasting, there is an exemption, but it applies to all. It technically doesn't apply to soccer, but it applies to all the traditional North American sports.
Okay. And you previously talked about, or you mentioned, the Curt Flood Act of 1998, named after Curt Flood, obviously, from the 1972 court decision. This was an attempt to limit antitrust protection of Major League Baseball?
Well, on its surface, or on its face, it was an attempt to limit it. But I think in reality, it really just entrenched the antitrust exemption. The major thing that happened after Flood, now both Flood and Toulson had dealt with the rights of players to be free during their career to switch teams at their own choosing, whereas the baseball rules permitted only, players could only change teams if their previous team had released them or given up their claim to their rights. Of course, what happens after Flood is that the Major League Baseball Players Association, with its director Marvin Miller, wins a great victory under labor law. So ultimately, the players prevail on, at least partially prevail, on these freedom issues by striking and then ultimately entering into collective bargaining agreements that give them certain rights to become free agents at certain times in their career. So what Toulson and Flood had hoped to win under antitrust law, ultimately their successors won under the sort of ambit of labor law. And the labor laws are exempt from the antitrust.
Okay, so that's just kind of another way of attacking these same issues, that the players have been more successful using labor law, particularly in Major League Baseball, have been quite successful in challenging some of these restrictions.
Right, so what the Curt Flood Act does is basically reaffirms that baseball has an antitrust exemption, but that the exemption doesn't apply to Major League Baseball labor relations. So in a sense, the Curt Flood Act represents a victory for Curt Flood and, by implication, other major league players, although interestingly enough, not minor league players. Major League Baseball can still control organized baseball can still control minor league players without having to worry about antitrust problems. So while it looks on its face like the Curt Flood Act was a victory for players over the antitrust exemption, they had already won that victory under labor law. So really, the Curt Flood Act, really, it seems to me, more than anything else, just sort of solidifies this anomaly that we call the baseball antitrust exemption, that there is no such exemption in the Curt Flood Act for other sports.
Okay. So now let's talk about more recent applications of the antitrust exemption. You hear about the antitrust exemption coming up with respect to franchise relocations, so when teams want to move from one place to another. How does the antitrust exemption apply there?
Yeah. Well, this is, along with player relations that we've been talking primarily about, these were the two major questions that have arisen over time under the antitrust exemption. All the way back in 1876, in the original constitution of the National League, the first modern professional baseball league in America, that the so-called territoriality principle was adopted that limits one team to each city. And now, because of competition and mergers, we now have a qualification of that, and the very largest cities may have more than one team, although normally not more than two. The general rule throughout organized baseball and other professional sports as well is that there's only one team in each city, and that team then has a monopoly over professional, whatever the sport is, baseball or football, in that city. And now it also extends to the right to broadcast. New Orleans cannot broadcast its games on the radio into Chicago unless the Chicago teams permit it. So this has been a question as whether or not these sorts of rules, because normally dividing up markets among competitors, like if Burger King and McDonald's and Wendy's got together and said the McDonald's will have all the hot dog and hamburger restaurants in the eastern third of the country and Burger King will take the middle and Wendy's will take the west, and nobody will be permitted to move out of their territory, that would be a per se violation of the federal antitrust laws. But in a sense, all professional sports leagues try to do this by limiting the number of teams. This became most apparent back in the 1980s, when Al Davis, the owner of the Oakland Raiders, decided to move his team to Los Angeles, even though there was already a team in Los Angeles, even though all the owners opposed this and refused to give Davis permission, he went ahead and moved anyway and then sued the National Football League and his fellow owners under the antitrust laws, claiming that the rules that restricted the ability of teams to move from one city to another violated the Sherman Act, and he won. Now, so this, of course, has been an important question for baseball as well. Does baseball's antitrust exemption permit baseball to restrict the movement of teams in a way that the Davis case indicated that the NFL and other leagues could not?
Okay, and what's the resolution of that?
Well, I don't know that we have an absolute resolution. there were some decisions, lower federal court decisions in the 1990s, particularly the Piazza versus Major League Baseball, or at least where some federal courts were inclined to read the exemption as applying only to player relations, since that's what Flood had been about and that's what Toulson had been about. In the Piazza case, the owner of the San Francisco Giants wanted to sell the team to a man named Piazza, who I think was the father of Mike Piazza, the famous catcher. So he wanted to buy the San Francisco Giants and move them to Tampa. This is before the Devil Rays had been created. Major League Baseball refused to approve this and threatened to expel the Giants if they moved to Tampa. And so Piazza brought suit against Major League Baseball. Piazza's suit was filed as an antitrust action. Major League Baseball defended on the grounds that it was immune, and the lower federal court disagreed that the immunity only extended to cases like Flood or Toulson, which involved players. The case then went back to trial, and there would have been an opportunity to appeal this, but it didn't go any farther because Piazza ultimately agreed to settle, and Major League Baseball paid him something like $6 million to drop his lawsuit. So we don't really know. Now, some people argue that the Curt Flood Act, by ratifying the exemption except as it applies to Major League Baseball, means then that baseball is free to limit franchise relocations or to close teams down, as it toyed with in the late 90s when there was some talk about contraction and eliminating the Minnesota Twins and the Montreal Expos. Other legal commentators think, though, that the Curt Flood Act now provides congressional sanction for this. Others argue, no, the Curt Flood Act is only about things that actually have to do with the operation of Major League or organized baseball, and that moving franchises around isn't really central to the operation of the sport, even in the way maybe the player contracts are.
Okay, so this is still unsettled, with at least some of the lower courts in Piazza finding that the antitrust exemption is particularly limited to issues such as player movement and things like that, and that baseball doesn't have an antitrust exemption for things that are not so closely related to baseball, such as franchise relocation. And we're kind of left in this nebulous zone where it's not clear exactly what the scope of that antitrust exemption is, because the Supreme Court hasn't ruled on it lately.
Yeah, I think if the argument question was, can, in the area of, say, concessions, do the antitrust laws apply to Major League Baseball teams in their negotiations with the people who supply caps or food for the ballpark or things like that? I think the argument is much stronger that that's outside of the baseball antitrust exemption, that selling hot dogs or selling logoed T-shirts is not an essential part of putting on the game. But obviously having players on the field, the basic rules of the game, those, of course, are clearly part of the business of baseball. Where the location of teams falls along that spectrum is an interesting question. And right now, it's not getting so much publicity at the moment, but there's an ongoing legal battle involving the Oakland Athletics and their desire to build a stadium in San Jose. Unlike the case in New York and Chicago and Los Angeles, where the Yankees and Mets and Cubs and White Sox and Angels and Dodgers agree to share the same metropolitan area, when the Kansas City Athletics moved to Oakland in 1967, they divided the Bay Area so that Oakland controls the east side of the Bay Area and San Francisco the west side, which would include the area going down to Santa Clara and San Jose. And so when Oakland wants to put its new stadium into San Jose, that would be invading the territory that had been reserved by agreement for the Giants. And that's... can you do that? Can you do that consistent with the antitrust laws?
Okay, and it differs depending on where you view that relocation on the scale of relation to baseball or not.
Now, I should say there is this extreme version, which some lower federal courts have embraced, that actually the baseball antitrust exemption, particularly after the Curt Flood Act, includes everything. So that baseball can't be sued under antitrust for any reason other than things having to do with Major League Baseball player relations. But that's such an extreme version of this. It's hard to believe that if the Supreme Court were to ever revisit it, that would really endorse that broad.
Okay. Do you know what Major League Baseball itself argues for? Do they argue for that most expansive?
They argue for the most expansive thing. On the other hand, they've historically been willing to settle cases on the margins. Well, like the Piazza case, right? Rather than actually litigate it, if they can settle it, they've been willing to do that.
Right.
So I think they understand and have for a long time that the antitrust exemption is sort of fragile. And if there's some controversy where Major League Baseball comes off looking greedy or selfish or acting contrary to the public interest, I think they appreciate that this is still the Congress can always repeal the Curt Flood Act, and then the Supreme Court can always reverse or sharply narrow Flood versus Kuhn. So this is a kind of valuable possession, but one you have to be very careful with or you'll lose it.
Right. Okay, well, we're getting close to the end here. Let's summarize a little bit. The antitrust exemption exists, and it affects different parties in different ways. So just to summarize, how do you think that the antitrust exemption affects baseball players?
Well, I think the most dramatic impact the exemption has is not the way it affects major league players, who obviously are highly paid and are free to become free agents at least after 6 years in Major League Baseball, but they're eligible for salary arbitration after 3 years. So major league players, I think, are not suffering. Minor league players, though, are still, one could argue, victimized. I mean, Toulson has never won. Minor league players don't have the freedom to shift from one organization to another until they reach their seventh year in the minor leagues. Every minor league has a salary cap. We haven't really talked about this because Major League Baseball has never had a salary cap, but most minor league players are forced to play. I think the players at AAA baseball make something like $60,000 a year, where the major league minimum is close to $500,000 now or something in that neighborhood. So, of course, any major league player who comes through the minor leagues has been affected by the antitrust exemption because of the rigid way in which minor leagues are operated. On the other hand, minor league baseball players are not really in a position to do very much about this, since they can always be released. And, of course, every minor league player imagines it's just a matter of time until they make it to the major leagues.
Okay, so it has a disproportionate negative effect on the minor league players.
Yeah, or at least that's the critics' argument. Okay. I suppose the Major League Organized Baseball would argue without these restrictions, minor league baseball being so unprofitable would just go out of business.
Yeah.
So there's that argument.
Yeah, I for one love minor league baseball. I just went to a Richmond Flying Squirrels game the other day. So it's fun. But yeah, that's an instance where this antitrust exemption applies.
Yes.
Okay, now how does it affect owners, the people in charge of Major League Baseball?
Well, I suppose the most important thing is that it allows them to control the number of teams. There's never been such a case involving other sports, but there's always the potential that the league itself could be deemed to be a monopoly. So say you and I try to organize a NFL team for Richmond, and we apply for admission and we get turned down, even though the NFL could obviously add additional teams. So we could, at least in theory, challenge the NFL as a monopoly and maybe even force them to, either force the Department of Justice to break the NFL into more than one league or at least force our admission. Baseball doesn't have to worry about that because they are clearly, under at least the standard interpretation, exempt from those sorts of antitrust challenges.
Yeah, but that has happened to the other leagues in the past.
It has happened.
USFL and Donald Trump and things like that.
The World Football League in the 70s.
Okay.
But so far, no one has been able to really establish that the NFL is such a predatory monopoly that there's no other possibility. And yet we never have any other leagues, right?
Right, yeah. I mean, there's other factors besides the antitrust exemption.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of money and investment costs.
And then getting your games on television and the networks not really wanting to deal with new leagues.
Okay, and then how does this exemption affect fans? Does it affect normal people at all?
Well, this, is the open question. I think this has always been one of the problems. I'm not sure fans were adversely affected even by the most rigid labor rules of the past. I mean, some people like the fact that players stayed on the same teams, that they didn't jump around like they do in the modern era. So I don't know that, every team is a monopoly. You know, if you live in Kansas City, the only option you have for Major League Baseball is to see the Royals. If somebody wanted to put another team in Kansas City, they couldn't. Although my experience has been that most sports fans don't desire more teams. When you start telling students in a sports law class or suggesting, well, maybe the NFL ought to be broken up and be forced to compete, and then you might easily have 90-some Major League Football teams. I found most students don't view that as attractive, right? That's kind of a bad idea, that they like the idea of there being one team per city. So fans are fickle, right? it is a mistake to think that football is somehow analogous to soft drinks, right? Uh-huh. Just because you need to have a Coke and a Pepsi and a 7-Up, but it's not clear you need three NFLs.
Right.
Most people, I think, would prefer to have a choice of soft drinks, but only a single major league in each sport.
Right. I mean, that's a philosophical question beyond the scope of this podcast. But yeah, I mean, that does raise interesting issues as to whether having one central organization that can control the game and the teams and things like that is beneficial to fans. You know, perhaps fans, that creates the optimal situation where...
Right. 'Cause you could say if you had three NFL teams in Kansas City, prices would have to go down.
Right, which would be a plus for fans.
But I think most fans would rather pay more to see... Because if you had three leagues, then it would always be unclear which one was the best. If you only have one league, then there's no question which is the Premier League. So even if you're paying $108 for your ticket, you're at least seeing the best league.
Right, and there's the idea of the shared community and stuff that comes from sports as well. So yeah, I mean, it's a complicated issue, and it depends on what you view as beneficial to the ordinary fan.
Yeah, so if a company like Coca-Cola had an antitrust exemption, there would be all sorts of harmful consequences of that, presumably.
Yeah, because they could raise prices and things like that.
Less clear, though, in the world of sports, whether controlling the supply is really as disadvantageous to fans as it would be in any other industry.
Okay. I guess getting ready to wrap up. Do you have any predictions about the future of the antitrust exemption? Is it here to stay?
I don't see anything happening at this point. You know, maybe if there's some substantial relocation, if some iconic team, you know, if the Boston Red Sox would, I don't know, take $100 million and move to Mexico City, you know, maybe that might prompt some further congressional intervention. But I think the people who run sports are too savvy to make the kind of blunders that could really change the legal landscape.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's a pretty safe and true prediction. So, okay, well, thanks for coming on the podcast today. I don't know if, do you have any recommendations of resources that people can turn to learn more about this if they're interested in getting into the nitty-gritty?
Quite a lot has been written about the baseball history, as probably most of your listeners know. The legal historian at the University of Georgia, Nathan Groh, has written a wonderful book on the 1922 case, and I think that would be a great place to start.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, it's a huge topic. There's lots of different issues going on there, so there's tons of material. I haven't read Mr. Groh's book, but I've read some articles by him, and there's definitely a lot of interesting stuff by him.
And my friend Brad Snyder's book on the Curt Flood case, A Well-Paid Slave, it would also be a wonderful place for someone who just wanted to learn about the long history of the antitrust exemption, at least up until the end of the last century.
Yeah, I've read that book. It's very interesting. It gives you a view into the legal preparation that went into the Curt Flood case and things like that. It's really interesting. Okay, well, yeah, I'll post links to some of this information and people can look that up on the website as well. Well, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Well, thank you. I very much enjoyed being here.
Yeah, no, it's been great. So this is our first episode, and I hope to have many more. This has been an episode of the Sports Law Biz podcast. This podcast is available through the Sports Law Biz website or through iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and YouTube. Before wrapping things up, I'd like to thank some people. First of all, I'd like to thank my friend Lieb Montoya for designing the Sports Law Biz podcast logo as well as the Sports Law Biz blog logo. His artistic ability certainly surpasses mine. If interested, you can check out more of Lieb's work on Instagram and Twitter His handle is at Lieb Montoya in both places. That's at L-I-B Montoya. Additionally, I'd like to thank the musical artist for providing this theme music that you're listening to right now. The artist is a band called The Losers. The album is entitled Young, Tough, Terrible. The track is Sports with an exclamation point. The label is Needle Drop Co. This music is available through a Creative Commons license of Attribution Non-Commercial 3.0 Unported. This podcast was produced and recorded by myself, Peter Ott, and you can reach me at my personal Twitter handle, at PeterJOTT, through the Sports Law Biz Twitter handle, at SportsLawBiz, or through email at sportslawbizblog@gmail.com. Any feedback is greatly appreciated. If you are interested in contributing to either the Sports Law Biz blog or podcast, definitely reach out to me. I love to talk to people about these issues, and I know I can use all the help I can get. Finally, I'd like to thank you for listening to this podcast. Hopefully it was enjoyable. If so, please spread the word and let your friends and colleagues know about it. Leave a review on iTunes. Any way you can spread the news about this podcast would be greatly appreciated. That's our episode today. Tune in next time to learn more about the law and business of sports. I'm looking forward to discussing it with you on the Sports Law Biz podcast.